You are listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison.
First Unitarian Society Madison presents the first Friday film for April, Growing Cities, on Friday, April 2nd. Growing Cities is a documentary film that examines the role of urban farming in America and asks how much power it has to change the way we eat. In their search for answers, the filmmakers Dan and Andrew take a road trip and meet the men and women who are challenging the way this country distributes its food. Register by 5 p.m. on Friday, April 2nd. Link to the film and after-film discussion will be sent to you by 5:15. Start the film by 5:58 and be ready to join the after-film discussion at 7:30 with local urban farming, food justice, and Save the Voight Farm proponents. Registration information can be found on the First Unitarian Society's webpage, fusmadison.org. For more information, call Tim at 608-630-3633. You are listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison and WORTFM.org.
Hello, I'm Debbie Russ with the BBC News. Trials in the United States of AstraZeneca's coronavirus vaccine have confirmed that it's safe and effective, paving the way for the country to start administering the jab. The US hasn't yet approved its use, as American health officials were waiting for the study's results. No one who received the vaccine became seriously ill with COVID-19. It proved nearly 80% effective at stopping symptomatic cases. More from our health reporter, Michelle Roberts.
It comes at a really important time because we know there's been a lot of attention on the AstraZeneca jab recently because of the reported concern about blood clots. A review's been done on that now with no evidence of a link. And we've seen some European countries starting to use it again after pausing for a little bit. So this just confirms again, it's safe, it's effective, and it works really well in the elderly population too, where we didn't have a massive amount of trial data before.
Suspected Islamist militants have attacked three villages in Niger, close to the border with Mali. Up to 40 people are reported to have been killed. An attack in the same region last week killed nearly 60 people. Will Ross reports.
A local official said armed men arrived on motorbikes in the three villages and shot at anyone they saw. The military in Niger has once again failed to protect these remote villages in the Tahoua region. Islamist militants are known to be active there as well as in the neighbouring Tillaberi region. The jihadists are quick to move across the borders of Mali, Niger and Burkina Faso. This latest violence came hours after a court in the capital Niamey confirmed Mohamed Bazoum as the new president following Niger's recent election. His greatest challenge is to help stop the terrifying spread of jihadist violence across the Sahel region.
African heads of state have been paying tribute to the former Tanzanian president, John Magufuli, at a state funeral in the capital, Dodoma. He died last week at the age of 61. The Tanzanian authorities say Mr. Magufuli, a coronavirus skeptic, died from heart failure. Athuman Atulia reports.
The Prime Minister has announced that there will be no queues for viewing the body, but instead the casket will be driven around the stadium for people to catch a final glimpse of the late president. Over the weekend, tens of thousands of residents of the commercial city of Dar es Salaam flooded the city roads to wave as his casket was driven around, and many more flocked to the main stadium where his body was laid for public viewing. The authorities have today confirmed that there was a stampede and an unspecified number of people were injured.
The French subsidiary of IKEA, the Swedish home furnishings giant, has gone on trial in France on charges of spying on staff and job applicants. Prosecutors say the firm spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on private investigators. World News from the BBC.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Budget Bicycle Center's used bicycle showroom located at 930 Regent Street. Open for curbside service estimates and sales, 251-1663. More information on Budget Bicycles services for new and used bicycles is available on the web at budgetbicyclectr.com.
Thank you. Good morning, it's 8:04, and you're tuned to the Monday 8 o'clock buzz on WORT 89.9 FM Madison and WORTFM.org. Reporting to you live from an underground bunker in an undisclosed location, this is Brian Standing. Starting off the program, well, of course it's racism. UW-Madison sociologist Pawan Dhingra tells us not to misinterpret recent attacks on Asian Americans. Excuse me, that's Pawan Dhingra from Amherst College. And police arrests have lasting traumatic impacts, not only on those directly involved, but on children bystanders as well. UW-Madison sociologist Julie Pullman-Tynan will join us with more. And when should police release body cam footage? Well, it turns out the public and police chiefs have different ideas about that. We'll talk with Daniel Bromberg from the University of New Hampshire. We'll have all that along with some announcements, a look at the weather, and some tasty tunes served up by our engineer, Doug Holtz, coming up right after this. It's 8:04. You're tuned to the 8 o'clock, or it's 8:09. You're tuned to the 8 o'clock buzz. We're having a little difficulty getting our first story on the line here, so let's go to the third segment that we have lined up here. As soon as I can get Doug's attention here, we've got a interview with Daniel Bromberg from the University of New Hampshire coming up right after this. In the wake of a spate of recent police shootings, including George Floyd in Minneapolis and Jacob Blake in Racine, many communities have begun using cameras worn on police officers' bodies to help document their activities. The thought is that such cameras may help provide evidence indicating whether or not shooting incidents are justified and perhaps act as a deterrent to violent behavior if police officers know they are being recorded. That's the theory. In practice, however, body-worn cameras have a host of problems and are by no means a panacea. Daniel Bromberg is an associate professor of political science at the University of New Hampshire who specializes in government accountability. Daniel Bromberg joins us now. Welcome to the 8 o'clock buzz.
Thanks so much. It's my pleasure to be here.
So tell us a little bit about the study you recently completed with Etienne Charbonneau. What research question were you trying to answer?
Yeah, sure. So we were really looking at two aspects of body-worn cameras. First, we were looking at how civilians perceive body-worn cameras and when they're interested in disclosure. But then we also asked police chiefs similar questions around when they would disclose body-worn cameras, the footage associated with body-worn cameras. There were two parts of this. We did an experiment. So half of our police chiefs received a body-worn camera footage, and the other half received both body-worn camera footage and a smartphone footage of the same incident. And we wanted to see if, you know, if one was circulating in the media already, if that would make a difference between when they would choose to disclose the footage or not. Our results show that that wouldn't change their behavior. So if there's a cell phone video out there, a police chief is going to behave the same as if there was one or wasn't one. You know, which was, we thought, good to see that that wouldn't shift their behavior. However, the other question we asked was how trust in their communities would affect their behavior. And from that perspective, we actually did see a difference. For the police chiefs that were able to release that footage, just the body-worn camera footage, if they had higher levels of trust in their community, they were more likely to then release that footage in a quicker timetable. So we essentially said, would you release it immediately, the raw footage, or would you wait for an internal investigation? And as levels of trust increase between that police chief and their community, their likelihood to release that earlier also increased. Go ahead, Brian.
Explain that a little bit. When you say trust in the community, are you referring to the community's trust in the police department or the police chief's trust in the citizens of their community?
Yeah, the second, the latter there. So the way that, you know, you test trust is there are any number of instruments that researchers could use. So these are surveys essentially that ask a series of questions. So we asked these police chiefs a series of these questions related to trust in their community. And what our findings show is that they were more likely to release that raw footage if they had higher levels of trust in their community.
And what would determine, I mean, this may be beyond the scope of your research, but what would determine whether or not a police chief trusted their community? It's interesting because that's sort of the reverse of the question we're usually asked and that we usually hear from police departments where they talk about, well, people don't trust us. So what does that mean? And what are the indicators of that?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think you're right in that most of the research focuses on the other side of the equation, which is why we were interested in this factor. Our research didn't focus on those motivating issues. However, what you do see is that basically if there are higher levels of what we would call social capital within the community, right? So if the community itself, you know, is more trusting with each other and engage with each other in more ways, then police happen to follow that same equation as well. They're members of that community as well, whether they're working there or living there and working there. So that's a possible explainer, but our research didn't get into that. It would ask questions of, do you trust the residents in your community to take on certain tasks within the community? Would you trust the residents of your community to do, they're not immediately coming to mind, but X, Y, and Z, and they would respond to those. And then when you get a whole list of, 10 to 15 of those responses, you could say, okay, this chief has a high level of trust in their community and the residents who live in their community.
Now, I can hear, some cynics may say, well, police forces that are racist are going to have less trust in their community if they're dealing with, populations that are of a different racial or ethnic background. And then, does that imply some sort of prejudice or bias on the part of the police department if they don't trust their own citizens?
Well, I guess not necessarily. But I'd have to see what that data would say to say, yes, there's, bias there or not.
Okay.
But I don't think it necessarily implies that. There was another side to our study, which we did ask, residents what they wanted to see with release of footage as well, right? So we actually surveyed 4,000 U.S. residents, 1,000 in Los Angeles, 1,000 in Seattle, and 1,000 in Charlotte, and then 1,000 U.S. residents at large. To see what their preferences were for disclosure.
Why did you pick those particular cities?
Yeah, good. They tend to be what research cites as the prototypical examples of different policy for disclosure. So, for example, Los Angeles will typically disclose footage within 4 to 6 weeks, and what they do is they release a narrated version. So they explain what's happening so viewers know, why is an officer drawing their firearm or why are they stepping back? Whereas Seattle releases footage pretty fast. Typically within 48 hours, footage is released in Seattle. And in North Carolina, and this may be shifting because there are a couple bills that are trying to make their way through the legislature, but currently you typically need a court order to get access to footage. So much more restrictive as far as what they're willing to disclose. And then the U.S. residents at large kind of provide us a baseline that we could compare all of that to. And what was striking about this was that residents, regardless of where they lived, all pretty much supported the same policy. And a plurality of residents, for the most part, we're willing to let police, law enforcement, go through an internal investigation first and then release that footage after. However, there were, upwards 20 to a little over 30%, depending on our samples, that were interested in seeing that raw footage immediately. They were not willing to kind of give law enforcement that time to conduct the internal investigation.
Did you see much difference between the cities that you singled out and the U.S. population as a whole?
So no, and that's what was striking to us. Often the conversation is that decisions are made at the local level because they reflect, local policy preferences. And what we saw was across the board, regardless of geographic location, residents wanted the same thing. So that was striking and really something that we found quite interesting.
Now, you mentioned I believe it was Los Angeles, that police have a practice where they narrate and essentially interpret the body cam footage. How popular was that option in your surveys?
Not as popular. I think it dropped below 20%. I could actually pull up that chart just so I can take a quick look. 21%, give or take. So it wasn't really that high. As far as police chiefs rated it a little higher, 27%, give or take. So it wasn't as popular. The release of the raw footage was more popular than the narrated version. But once again, you know, there was a plurality of residents across the United States that were willing to let the law enforcement go through with that internal investigation. So we were looking at about 43% of white residents. And then as far as our respondents of color, about 38% of them were willing to let law enforcement go through that internal investigation.
And so there's a significant difference there between white respondents and people of color. What do you attribute that to?
Essentially factors of trust, right? So we did also look at trust of those residents within with their law enforcement. And we tried to ask very specifically about your law enforcement as opposed to your police officers, as opposed to kind of this nationalized perspective of it. So there were different levels of trust, you know, between residents of color and the white residents. And, you know, those did mediate one's willingness to let law enforcement go through that internal investigation. But the numbers, they changed. And I don't want to say they weren't, you know, significantly. I mean, statistically, they were significant. And there was, you know, there was a drop, but it wasn't drastic. You know, you're talking 38% to 43%. So, you know, a 5-point drop. And then same with releasing that footage immediately. We're really within, you know, 3 to 5 percentage points on both of them. So it wasn't really drastic. Where we did see, you know, a substantial difference was a police chief's willingness to release that footage immediately. You know, they were somewhere around 12%, right, as far as their willingness to do that. You know, a plurality of police chiefs really did want to conduct that internal investigation first prior to releasing the footage. So there is a distinction there between what residents were looking for and what police chiefs were willing to do.
Now, you mentioned that part of your research involved looking at footage or positing the idea that there was cell phone footage in addition to body cam footage available. Have you looked at all into the sort of subjective viewpoint of point of view body-worn cameras, where there's a mounting degree of evidence that seems to suggest that by seeing it from someone's point of view, first off, you may get a misleading idea of what happened, but secondly, that it tends to encourage people to empathize with the officer in that circumstance. Have you looked at that, or is that something you're going to be looking at in the future?
Yeah, so we don't do point of view perspectives. However, there's a good deal of research out there that you're referencing. You know, there's research that shows if you have a camera stationary in the corner of a room and you have a camera worn on, you know, the body of someone, your perspective's going to shift, right? And there's been evidence of this even done with, you know, cadets in, you know, police training facilities. And when they thought it was appropriate to discharge a firearm or not, you know, looking at that same exact footage. So there is definitely what they call a camera bias, depending on, you know, where that is shot from. That's not our expertise, so we don't dig into that. You know, what I would say is for all of our sports fans out there, you know, people have cited this before. I mean, you think about a football game, you think about the number of angles that you have, the number of cameras you have, and yet we still argue about whether or not that ball crossed the plane of a you know, a goal line. There are so many different angles and ways to view something, and it's really challenging to get to that, you know, straightforward objective view every single time. So there is certainly something to what you're saying. And I'm not exactly sure about the empathizing or not in that perspective. But I would say it's really challenging to get that, you know, all those views when we're looking at one particular view.
All right. We've been speaking with Daniel Bromberg from the University of New Hampshire. Thank you so much for joining us in the 8 o'clock buzz.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you.
WORT is hiring a volunteer and outreach coordinator to recruit, place, and manage 300-plus volunteers in positions to support the ongoing work of the station and to expand the station's visibility and reach in the community. This full-time, salaried union position is part of the station's six-member staff collective. Applicants must have 2 or more years of paid or unpaid volunteer management, including event staffing, meeting facilitation, training, and community outreach. Proficiency in current computer technology, including Google Documents and Drive, databases, and video conferencing is required. Experience in digital marketing and social media is desired. Great benefits include health, dental, vacation, a relaxed work atmosphere, and the opportunity to make a difference in our community. WORT-FM is an equal opportunity employer. Persons from underrepresented communities and those who foster and promote the values of diversity and inclusion are strongly encouraged to apply. The position description and application are available online at wortfm.org/jobs. The application deadline is 5 p.m. on April 9th.
Day 25, you're tuned to the 8 o'clock buzz on WORT. This is Brian Standing. So the a couple things coming up in the area, safe online types of activities that may be of interest. First off, on the 23rd, which would be tomorrow, there is a seminar. This is at noon, I believe. Let's see here. Yes, no, I'm sorry, 6 o'clock p.m. Tomorrow night, sponsored by the International Marxist Tendency Madison Branch, Automation and Job Loss, Who Benefits from New Technology Under Capitalism? And it's a Facebook event. You can find out more by going to Facebook and looking for International Marxist Tendency. You can also find that at our friends at the Isthmus. If you go to isthmus.com events, you should be able to find that online thing. It is an RSVP, so go ahead and RSVP to that, and you can check that out. Also online, this one's taking place on the 24th, Wednesday at noon. This is a noon event. The UW African Studies lecture series continues, Africa at Noon. And this one is focused on the way of the Neo-Griot, a journey towards a truly African-American theater, presented by Mark Hairston via Zoom. It is free. There is an RSVP for that as well. And again, if you go to our friends at isthmus.com and look for Africa at Noon, it's probably the best way to find the link to that Zoom event, which takes place, as we said, Wednesday, March 24th at noon o'clock. And let's take a look at the weather forecast for the Madison area. I hope you enjoyed the nice weather over the weekend, because this week looks like it's going to be pretty wet. It's going to be cloudy today with highs around 60 and then cooling off considerably for the rest of the week. And bringing with that is also some rain, thunderstorms, maybe a possibility of light snow, maybe Thursday or Friday. Most of the rain's going to hit around Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday are probably the rainiest days of the week. Clearing up a bit on Friday, but still a 20% chance of light rain and snow Friday night and Saturday morning. And then Saturday and Sunday, both cooler, somewhat warmer, lows in the 50s, and with a 20% chance of light rain. And of course, Rob McClure will have much more detail about that weather forecast coming up when he rolls into the station virtually, I believe, around 10 a.m. during Global Revolutions. And that brings us to the song of the week. Doug Holtz, what's rattling around your musical brain today?
Well, I was driving around yesterday and I just saw all the people outside enjoying the sunshine. And I know we won't be able to do it this week, but this song just kind of struck me yesterday. And this is by Beta Band, and it's from Hot Shots 2, and this is Quiet.
And the fears come rolling.
Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba
It's 8:30. You're tuned to the 8 o'clock buzz on WORT. This is Brian Standing. As of 2016, the United States had 2.2 million people in prison. That gives the United States not only the largest incarcerated population in the world, but the highest incarceration rate per capita anywhere as well. Much has been written about the toll incarceration takes on the imprisoned population, but there's been less attention paid to the collateral damage inflicted on others. Every person imprisoned has others in their lives who are also affected, and the toll may be greatest on children. Dr. Julie Pullman-Tynan is the Dorothy A. O'Brien Professor in Human Ecology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where she teaches the Human Development and Family Studies Department in the School of Human Ecology. Pullman-Tynan has co-authored a new study, Getting Under the Skin, Physiological Stress and Witnessing Paternal Arrest in Young Children with Incarcerated Fathers. Julie Pullman-Tynan joins us now by phone. Welcome to the 8 o'clock buzz.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's start with, one of the things that I found interesting is that your study by the title focuses on the physiological impacts rather than the psychological ones of children who witness their parents and in particular fathers being arrested. What sorts of reactions did you measure?
Well, we actually collected hair from the kids, and using the hair, we can assess the amounts of stress hormones in the children over the past several months. And so we looked at the two stress hormones, cortisol and cortisone. And those are reflections of reactions in the body that occur when a person feels stressed, such as elevated heart rate, dry mouth, sweating, wanting to flee, you know, those kind of real fear reactions. And so the innovation of the study is really linking what's going on in the kids' lives, that is witnessing their father's arrest before the father was incarcerated, and then what is happening in the children's bodies and brains.
And what sort of time frame does this, are you able to measure here? I mean, are these stress reactions that occur at that moment and then are recorded in hair, or are these ongoing stress reactions that accumulate over time?
They're really ongoing stress reactions that accumulate over time. It's possible to measure what's happening in the moment through other measures like blood sampling or saliva or urine, but the chances that a researcher is going to be there at the time of that kind of traumatic event is like unheard of. And so we used this unique methodology so we could look at what was going on in their bodies between 1 and 3 months after the event happened. And that's why we also looked at other things going on in the kids' environment, such as if they had witnessed domestic violence or the parent's crime, just to be able to kind of adjust for those kinds of other traumatic events going on. And what we found, even controlling for those kinds of things and a number of other factors, is there was still this strong association between a kid witnessing their father's arrest and elevated physiological reactions. Now, I just want to also mention that for the kids who were already really stressed out based on report of their behavioral stress symptoms, witnessing that father's arrest led to what's called a blunted stress reaction. And that is kind of the worst stress reaction that we can see and is similar to people experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder. And what it really means is that the kids' ability to respond to stress had been dampened by, you know, what was happening in their environment. And it means that in the future, they're less likely to be able to respond to stressful events in an appropriate way. And so it's considered pretty extreme.
So it's as if they are burnt out on stress.
Yes, exactly. And it really does affect not only the function of their bodies, but also the structure and function of their brains, especially when they're so young. Because in the study, the kids are between 2 and 6 years of age, and that's a really important time for the brain to develop and for children's self-regulation and stress responses to develop. So what we're concerned about is that this may have some lasting effect on their lives.
And what, I mean, what, in addition to that, I mean, what are some of those, let's elaborate a little bit on that. What are some of those potential long-term or lifetime, perhaps, impacts even on children who witness this kind of event?
Well, there isn't the greatest research on children who witness this specific event, but we know children who experience the incarceration of a parent are more likely in the long run to have less optimal health, more behavioral symptoms such as acting out and aggression, more depression and withdrawal, less academic achievement, and even struggles into their early adulthood. And we know also from the research that when their parent is arrested early in their life, that this makes an even greater impact on their development over time. But what has happened is that we don't necessarily understand, you know, what is going on in the child's brain and body, how do these experiences, quote, get under the skin? And that's where the innovation of this study lies, is that we're starting to document what are some of the specific experiences that the kids can have that really affect not only their behavior and their well-being, but, you know, from a general perspective, but also it's really affecting their brains and their bodies.
And what do we know about the continued presence of stress hormones in the body?
Well, we know that it can lead to numerous heart problems, behavioral symptoms, mental health symptoms. It can cause problems with day-to-day functioning. It can lead to inflammation. There's all sorts of research focusing on long-term effects of stress hormones on the body. But when it happens in young children, what you really worry about is not just what's happening in those different systems in the body. It's also their brains are basically being wired in a certain way. So that means that in the future, when they are exposed to just even normal stressors, that they just don't have the ability to regulate that response. So they may be more likely to like act out or get in trouble or engage in high-risk behaviors to try to regulate themselves. And so that's why it's really important to do a couple of different things. One is to, you know, provide interventions for the kids so they can learn different ways of coping. But also, as a society, it would be really important to protect the kids. And that is during any kind of law enforcement or police procedures, there are model practices that involve how to conduct arrests when children are present. And there are federal webinars and trainings that police departments and sheriff's departments can use in order to implement these model protocols. And in doing so, we can see that, children are then less exposed to the trauma of witnessing a parent's arrest.
Do any of those protocols talk about simply reducing arrests, and particularly for nonviolent offenses?
Yeah, that's the first important step is reducing arrests, reducing implicit bias, so that people who, you know, are black and brown don't experience disproportionate levels of arrests. But then also, if arrest is going to occur, trying to protect children, make sure the child isn't present, asking a parent to step out of a house, making sure that the child is cared for in their absence, and limiting the use of any kind of violence. And then if a child is there, having officers try to help the parent, you know, say goodbye, help calm the child, make sure the child is in, you know, a safe place so they don't have to ride in the police vehicle, et cetera, but really trying to reduce the negative experience and reduce the trauma on children.
So we've been talking primarily about domestic crime arrests or people who are accused of a domestic crime, but I can't help but draw a comparison here with what's going on at the border, where we have children who are separated from their parents or perhaps removed from their parents, or parents who are arrested on immigration charges. Have you looked at that issue, or would you expect that to be similar to what your study has observed?
We haven't specifically looked at that, but I am in the process of collaborating with some colleagues to draw some comparisons across the different groups. So we know children whose parents are arrested for a variety of different factors can experience trauma and then separation from their parents that's, you know, forced or enforced. And that happens at the border too, where if a parent is arrested on immigration charges and a child is present and then the child is separated from the parent, that can be extremely stressful for children. And so we know some of the underlying processes are similar, how children react, especially when children are young, how being separated from a parent is one of the most traumatic things that they can experience. And so there are parallels, although the exact type of research that I've done with children whose parents are incarcerated hasn't necessarily been done with children at the border, but there are definitely parallels.
So what has the reaction been to your report so far? Have you shared this, for example, with law enforcement authorities?
Yes, indeed. And I've had a few other, you know, pieces come out where I've shared with law enforcement. For example, in this area, I've shared with the Dane County Sheriff's Department because some of our data were collected in Dane County and adjacent counties. And honestly, the sheriff's office has not responded to me, but I have worked with them on data collection in the jail for about 15 years, and they're generally really responsive as far as, like, family issues. And so, you know, hopefully there'll be some movement in the future because I think that there are some really basic things that law enforcement can do that can help the situation, especially for young children, because young children haven't done anything. They're just in the wrong place at the wrong time. And it's really beholden on society to make sure that we have things in place to protect them from these exposures.
So what's next for your research? You mentioned possibly looking at some parallels with immigration issues. What else are you looking at?
Well, we're looking at longer-term effects of incarceration on children. We're also looking at interventions designed to help children. So, for example, I've worked with Sesame Street on some materials that are designed to help families affected by parental incarceration. And so we've evaluated those materials, but now we're also evaluating and visiting interventions. So how can you ease that separation between a parent and a child through different ways of visiting, such as video chatting? And so we're looking at that and then also drawing some parallels to, you know, children separated because of immigration issues and how video chat might be able to help those kids, and just the way it has with children separated from their parents because of military service or other reasons for parental absence. So we're trying to get into, you know, that area to see what can we do to help.
And what about the long-term physiological and psychological impacts? Are you looking at any sort of longitudinal studies on this issue?
Yeah, we're in the process of planning a longitudinal study right now that we look at brain development and, you know, symptoms and academic development and all sorts of things over time in families in which there have been different kinds of trauma, or they're called adverse childhood experiences. So kids who experience adversity, such as having someone in their household or their parent incarcerated, having a parent who uses substances, any kind of maltreatment, other kinds of things. And we're submitting a grant application to be able to look at the children from their prenatal development all the way through 10 years of age. And so we're hopefully going to be able to study their physiological stress, their brain development, and their behavior development in that family and community context to better understand what's going on and then how can we help in the future.
All right. We've been speaking with University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Human Ecology Professor Julie Pullman-Tynan. Thank you so much for joining us on the 8 o'clock buzz.
Thank you so much. Have a nice day.
We'll be back with Daniel Bromberg from the University of New Hampshire coming up right after this.
The end is near. It's going to happen Monday when the fifth and final installment of the San Francisco Mime Troupe's Tales of the Resistance comes to the Access Hour. All four storylines converge in one exciting hour of radio noir, medical drama, horror, and sci-fi. Loads of comedy, music, and radical satire here on Monday, March 22nd at 7 p.m. on WORT's Access Hour.
I'm just an average man with an average life. I work from 9 to 5. Hey, hell, I pay.
It's 8:46. You're tuned to the 8 o'clock buzz on WORT. This is Brian Standing. On March 17th, Georgia prosecutors charged Robert Aaron Long with 8 counts of murder stemming from a series of shootings at 3 Atlanta area spas. Although 6 of the 8 dead were Asian American, the Cherokee County Sheriff and the FBI stated they did not believe that the crime was racially motivated. Asian American activists and Georgia politicians, including Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms and Senator Raphael Warnock, have pushed back against that assertion. Stop AAPI Hate, a coalition fighting Asian American and Pacific Islander racism, has documented almost 4,000 incidents of violence or threats directed against Asian Americans over the past year. Pawan Dhingra is a professor of sociology and American studies at Amherst College who studies race issues and joins us now by phone. Welcome to the 8 o'clock buzz.
Thank you for having me.
So what do you make of Cherokee County Sheriff Captain Jay Baker's statement that the suspect in the shootings simply had a bad day?
I think that I and so many others find that statement to be hurtful, painful. Imagine being a family member of someone who was murdered that day and being told that the person who took your family member's life was just having a bad day and was at the end of their rope. You know, you're creating sympathy for the shooter rather than sympathy for the victims. And I think it just helps demonstrate that the issues at stake in this situation are not being taken very seriously.
Now, journalists later uncovered Captain Baker's Facebook posts promoting T-shirts satirizing coronavirus as a, quote, imported virus from China. How has the pandemic contributed to anti-Asian bigotry?
I really appreciate that question and the way you're phrasing it with the word contributed to, because it's not as if anti-Asian American racism and bigotry weren't around before the pandemic. A lot of anti-Asian racism happens at key inflection points in American, you know, society. So you're going to go back to whenever there's a concern around, you know, health or job security or foreign intervention. Think about World War II, and we interned Japanese Americans then out of fear of their allegiance to the country. We think about when the Japanese auto industry was overtaking American auto industry. There's a lot of harassment for Japanese and Chinese American, even a murder of a Chinese American in Detroit. In other words, when Americans feel threatened by outsiders, by something going on in Asia, Asian Americans bear the brunt of this. So it was only a matter of time when the virus was coming from China, and then former President Trump made it that his calling card to refer to that, and then made up terms around that, that Asian Americans were going to be impacted by, you know, violence, by slurs, by harassment, by evil stares, and all of those things.
Now, there's a perception among many that even for native-born people of Asian ancestry, that they are immigrants and that they are not citizens. How difficult is that to combat?
That's such a helpful question, because there's so many times, and I've experienced this, and everyone I know has experienced this who's Asian American, that you get assumed to be Asian first and American second. You have to kind of prove your Americanness. And it happens in subtle, and it happens in ways that when the person you're talking to doesn't even mean any harm. So, for instance, you may get told, oh, you speak English really well, as if somehow I wouldn't speak English well, having grown up in this country and being educated here and everything else, like the person I'm speaking to. You know, or tell me about where you're really from, as if I'm not really from where I tell you I'm from, if I'm not really from Cleveland or Dallas or somewhere else where I when you ask me where I'm from. So those people are not, they're not ill-intentioned, but it just demonstrates that even, you know, thoughtful, caring people carry an assumption that Asian Americans are not really members of this country. So you connect that kind of underlying this general assumption with a real concern we may have right now around someone carrying a disease or someone, you know, being a temptation to me that I think is a threat, right? It doesn't take much of a leap to say, well, I'm now going to attack that person who I already suspected as being a foreigner, but now I think of as a dangerous foreigner, right? It gives license to that kind of attack. And this is why even if the shooter, right, did not articulate anti-Asian sentiments, it's something that we have to recognize as part of the landscape. And if I could just quickly add one more thing. So, you know, I've done a lot of research on Asian American issues and cross different spectrums. And my latest book is on Asian Americans in education in schools. It's called Hyper Education. And you see there well-meaning teachers and educators also framing Asian American students, even high achieving students, as somehow creating problems in the school because of a quote-unquote foreign culture. So it permeates a lot of our understandings of the group, even outside of this most violent crimes that we're talking about this week.
And, you know, in contrast, for example, we don't say something similar about someone who might have an Irish surname or an Italian surname or a Polish surname. We seem to have learned the lesson over the years that those kinds of comments are not appropriate. Why do we, in this culture, do we think that it's still appropriate to say that about Asian Americans or Latino Americans or Black Americans and not people of a similar skin color?
It's one thing to say, you know, I noticed your background. I wanted to ask you about it. That can be kind of polite. That can be kind of nice. But it's not. I'm not asking you that because I don't think you really are an American also. But when Asian Americans get asked that question, that's the kind of implication. And that's oftentimes what you actually hear. Oh, I'm surprised you're from this country. And, you know, the reason has to do with, you know, race and our history of race and thinking about white Americans as somehow like the real inhabitants of this country, right? No one really questions this kind of expectations or practices of, you know, the average person walking around, average white American. And if I just ask you or any of the listeners, right, just describe, you know, when I say the average American, what picture comes to mind in our heads? I'll admit myself, I think of a white male, right? And that's just because we've all been socialized to think that whites are the real inhabitants of the nation. Everyone else kind of, you know, is a guest or visiting or has to prove themselves as worthy of being a real inhabitor. And again, that is just something that we've taken for granted, and the media contributes to this in ways through their characterizations of different groups. And, you know, imagine all the movies you've seen where the Asian character doesn't really speak, right? Does that some kind of like martial arts expertise or something else? That happens constantly. And we just take it for granted, as if that's somehow normal. But it's not normal, right? And so when the media doesn't depict people properly, our history books don't tell us full histories, and we have, you know, all these other kind of assumptions around race, it's almost inevitable that we're going to frame people in a certain way compared to other people.
Now, turning back to the Atlanta shootings, reportedly Robert Aaron Long has claimed he was motivated by tension between his Christian background and what he termed a sex addiction, and that he was not motivated by anti-Asian bias. You've written that this distinction doesn't matter. Why is that?
So, thank you for that. So, it doesn't matter in the following way. I mean, it can matter, obviously, in certain ways, but we shouldn't get hung up on whether or not he said, yeah, I was driven by a hatred of Asian women, Asian American women, right? Because there are ways in which race shapes the on our understandings of people in implicit ways. There are studies that show that Asian Americans get perceived as un-American, as foreigners, unless there's something about them that really demonstrates an American-like identity. And so, in other words, there's a lot in Asian American history is full of instances of treating Asian American women as sexually submissive, as prostitutes, assuming they're prostitutes. All of these things about them that informs how we think about this group. So we don't need, I mean, we don't have to think, well, did he say something racist about them or not, to decide if race matters. Because race can matter and it shapes how we think about all kinds of groups. I mean, it defies logic, frankly, to say that someone sees, you know, Asian American women and doesn't realize that they're Asian. Okay. And when you realize someone's Asian, right, it does conjure up certain assumptions around them, given our cultural stereotypes, right, given how little we know about these groups, how little voice and agency they're given. But how often do you hear an Asian American woman articulating her own background, her own point of view? It almost never happens in the media. So we have to realize all this context sets the stage for some of what happened. And I'm not saying it all is because of race, but we can't say none of it is because of race either.
Now, your research has focused on the intersection of race, gender, and class in American society. It seems the Atlanta shootings fit squarely right in the middle of the intersection of those three phenomena. Can you describe that?
Yeah, that's really well put, because we're talking about women who are in, you know, precarious work, you know, probably poor, relatively poorly paid, less respected work, long hours, right? And this is something that we have to realize is also a part of this situation. We can talk about it in terms of race, and we're talking about it in terms of gender, but we should realize that there were people who were at work who were gunned down in their workplace because of the work they are thought to be doing, right? So this is as much a worker issue, a workplace issue, as it is around race and gender. And we're not, you know, we may be focusing more on part of that equation than the full part of it, the other part of it. And when you ask that question, it's really helpful because it makes us attend to all the complexities going on right now, right? So yes, Asian American women are seen in a particular sexualized way oftentimes, especially if someone has a reason to think they're part of some kind of, you know, industry or line of work. But while that matters, right, it helps set the stage for what happened, right, we have to realize that people were killed in their workplace because of the work they were thought to be doing, and are we protecting workers enough? Are we giving them the respect they deserve, the right salaries they deserve, the safe conditions they deserve, and everything else? And that's a question I think policymakers, right, should be thinking about to a good degree.
All right. We've been speaking with Amherst College sociologist Pawan Dhingra. Thank you so much for joining us on the 8 o'clock buzz.
Thank you for having me.
And that wraps up our program for today. I'd like to thank our guests, Pawan Dhingra from Amherst College, Julie Pullman-Tyner from the University of Wisconsin, and Daniel Bromberg from the University of New Hampshire. Kai Brito produced today's program, lined up all the terrific guests you heard here on the program. And thanks to Doug Holtz for taking care of the soundboard and the savory tunes this and every week. This is WORT 89.9 FM Madison. We are also live streaming and podcasting at WORTFM.org. We've got an app out there too if you want to consume your audio that way, and you can find that on Google Play or on the Apple Store. My name is Brian Standing. Stay well, stay sane, stay home if you can. Global Revolutions is coming up next, right after the Insurgent Radio Kiosk.
Come on, yo. You know what?
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Monday, March 22nd.
What I say, what the fuck I feel on the real.
What the deal?
Today marks the passing of MC Fife Dawg 5 years ago. Fife Dawg was a member of the seminal hip-hop group A Tribe Called Quest. All six of the group's albums, which include 1990's People's Instinctive Travels and the Paths of Rhythm, 1991's The Low End Theory, and 1993's Midnight Marauders, are ranked gold or platinum. Fife Dawg spent the months before his death working on the group's first album in 18 years. That album, We Got It From Here, Thank You For Your Service, was released in November 2016. On this day 49 years ago, the United States Supreme Court ruled in the case Eisenstadt versus Baird that people who are unmarried have the right to possess contraceptives. The case was brought by a birth control advocate in Massachusetts, arrested for giving contraceptives to an unmarried woman. He did so purposely in order to challenge the state's Crimes Against Chastity Code.
Now tell me what you rhyming for. This shit is all about flows. The fashion show. Hip Hop 101, Professor Diggy, yo.
Now for today's announcements. Tonight at 6:30 p.m., mystery writer and publisher David Benjamin will outline the anatomy of a good mystery in an evening virtual event hosted by the DeForest Area Public Library. The event is free and open to the public, but registration is required. For more, head to DeForest.